All right, we're beginning here on the top of Kuf Mem Bet Amud Aleph. We left off yesterday trying to understand the statement of Rav Huna, that Rav Huna says that I couldn't find any author or any explanation for the position in our Mishnah that you're able to grant ownership to an Umbar. So we tested different possibilities, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, and the Gemara slowly rejected each of them. The last attempts that we made were in the language of the Mishnah, trying to suggest Yalda, instead of reading it as that she will give birth, but Yalda is that she did give birth, or Bimimvasereni, bringing the information to light. We rejected all of those because of the language in the Mishnah doesn't support them. So now here we have another suggestion about the language of the Mishnah, the Lemele. Let us say that the Mishnah is a case, Amar Likishite Leid, that when I do give birth, meaning that not like what we said in the Mishnah, Dim Teled Ishti Zachar, but Likishite Leid, when she does give birth, that's when it will take effect. So in that way, at the moment that he is gifting the item to the Vlad, nothing's happening at that point in time. The suggestion is that once she gives birth, then it will take effect. So not that, if my wife gives birth to this, then I'm granting the gift to the Ubar. Rather, it is when my wife gives birth, then at that moment, the Ubar, which is now a born child, will take possession of it. So you're granting him future ownership in the gift that you are giving. Umar says, that doesn't work either. Ravuna l'tame. That's because it is Ravuna l'shitato. We've seen such a machloket in Davar Shelo Bali Olam as well, which is that if you do grant ownership through Davar Shelo Bali Olam, even if it fails because of Davar Shelo Bali Olam, maybe it can take effect when it becomes Meshim Bali Olam, once it comes into effect. So that's what we have here, a similar machloket, which is Dam Rav Huna, Af L'Kishite Leid Lo Kana. Rav Huna is L'Shitato, who believes that if you gift it to the Ubar, then even when the Ubar is born, it does not take effect. The Amar of Nachman, a mezakel Ubar, someone who grants an item, an ownership to an Ubar, lo kana, then it's ineffective. You can't grant ownership to an Ubar. Likishite Leid, on the other hand, if you say, once the Ubar is born, it should take possession, then kana, it is successful. So here you have a machloket, Rav Nachman and Rav Huna, as to whether in the future you can grant ownership to the Ubar. Rav Huna Amar, Af Kelishite Leid Lo Kana. Rav Huna argues here, as we noted before, that this is his position. Even after you give birth, there is no acquisition by the Ubar. Rav Sheshet Amar, Echadzeh Vechadzeh Kana. The third opinion, which is Rav Sheshet, who says that either way it works. Whether you use the language of Mezakel Ubar, or whether you use the language of the Kishite Leid, both of them are effective. So now, first of all, just dealing with our Mishnah, the problem for Rav Huna is that Rav Huna is saying, I don't know of any author of our Mishnah, or I can't explain the reason behind our Mishnah. Gemara says, well, just use the language of L'Kishite Leid. When in the future she gives birth, that's when it'll take effect. Problem with that is that Rav Huna himself does not subscribe to that. So Rav Huna in his own Shita can't accept that as the explanation for the Mishnah. And that's why he says, I can't find authorship for the Mishnah. Aside from that, now you have a machloket here between Rav Nachman and Rav Huna, which turns out to be interesting. Which is yesterday we noted that Rav Huna is amongst those Amoraim and Tanaim that the Gemara in Yevamot enumerates as believing that you can be makne davar shelo bali olam, that you can actually be makne something that doesn't exist in the world. So it turned out for Rav Huna, who believes that davar shelo bali olam you can transact in, but davar she'eino bali olam, to the person that it does not exist, that you can't do. That's already we clarified yesterday. But it will turn out that even though you can transact in Davar Shelo Bali Olam, you can't transact to a party, She'eino Ba'olam, that is yet to be in the world. On the other hand, Rav Nachman has the opposite position. Rav Nachman believes, as we see over here, Mezekeh Lubar Lokana, believes that Davar Shelo Bali Olam, you can't transact in. Davar She'eino Ba'olam, something that doesn't exist yet, you can transact with. So it's the opposite opinions. Rav Huna believes that Davar Shelo Bali Olam you can transact with, but if the receiving party has yet to exist, then you cannot transact. And Rav Nachman has the other way around. Rav Nachman says, if it's Davar Shelo Bali Olam you can't transact, but if it's the recipient is not in the world yet, then it will be effective. Now, the truth is it's only effective after the Ubar is born. From that, you see that, first of all, Rav Huna believes, Davar Shelo Be'Olam, like Rabbi Meir, you can transact in. The recipient is Eino Be'Olam. Over there, he says that an Ubar doesn't exist. If it doesn't exist, then you can't have a Kinyan take effect at all. On the other hand, Rav Nachman believes, Davar Shelo Be'Olam, you can't transact in. Davar She'Eino Be'Olam, it can transact with, but that would be strange. Why would you allow that if you don't allow Davar Shelo Be'Olam? So underlying Rav Nachman's opinion is a belief that an Ubar can be koneh. Well, if an Ubar can be koneh, then what does he say? Mezakeh l'Ubar lo kana. What you have to say is that he considers the Ubar to be yeshno be'olam, but halachically, it doesn't have the status to accept the gift. As soon as it has the status to accept the gift, it becomes effective, and that's when it's born. So the Ubar itself is yeshno be'olam. It's just that there is a halachic impediment to him taking possession of it because an Ubar is not classified as a halachic recipient. Once the Ubar is born, he becomes a halachic recipient, and that's why it goes effective at that point in time. So then, you also have to say here, for Rav Nachman's position, that whatever kinyan was used still exists at the time that the child is born. If you simply grant it to the child, and he has no halachic status to receive it, then it won't happen later on when he does gain that halachic status because the kinyan doesn't exist anymore. So you have to use a mechanism or a kinyan that is still around at the time that the child is born. Wait. So then we have similar idea in the Gemara in Kiddushin with regards to someone who gave Kiddushin with the intent that it only go effective at a later date. And over there we said that the kinyan still has to be around, or whatever mechanism you're using has to still be around, because otherwise the kinyan can't be effective at that point in time. If you make the kinyan effective immediately with some sort of tnai or condition, that's one thing. But if you only make the kinyan effective in the future, then the kinyan has to be around at that point in time. So then you have to suggest that over here, either they're using a shtar to do it, which is still around then, mizakya yidei acher, you do it through a third party who takes possession on behalf of this party, and then they're still around, the object's still around when it comes to the birth of the child. But you will have to come up with a solution that at least addresses that point, which is that the kinyan's only effective at the time of birth. That also means that he could retract the gift. Until the child is born, you could retract the gift because nothing happens until that point. That's the effective date of the kinyan. So those are the nuances of Rav Nachman's position. And then we have Rav Sheshet, who believes that doesn't matter what you do, you can be mezakeh the ubar, which means that you have the ability to grant ownership to an ubar, as well as if you try to give it to after it's born, then you can also do that, because obviously if you can be makneh to the ubar today, then you certainly can be makneh to in the future, because that's no different than any other person, where you can choose the effective date of when the kinyan goes effective. So that's Rav Sheshet's position, and the Balei HaTosafot over here note that in Rav Sheshet's position, he says, V'nir l'ri, d'savar Rav Sheshet, d'l'rabbanan d'Rav Yossi, nami ubar itle z'chia. We saw yesterday that there was the position of Rabbi Yossi, who said by Truma that an Ubar has the ability to take possession and affect the outcome of situations. So what the Balei HaTosafot note over here is that Rav Sheshet believes that that's not only the position of Rabbi Yossi, but even the position of the Chachamim that argue on Rabbi Yossi. And the reason that the Chachamim who argue on Rabbi Yossi do not agree with Rabbi Yossi is not because they don't believe that an Ubar has a Zchia, but rather because of the probabilities, which is that the probability that this is a male child is below the 50% line. You have a 50-50 shot that it's a male or a female, but then you also have the risk of hapala, the risk of a miscarriage. If you add together the risk of a miscarriage plus the 50% of females, then you have a minority of outcomes in which there will be a male child that is born. And for that reason, they say that Rabbi Yossi is wrong. This Ubar doesn't have impact. It's not because we don't believe that an Ubar is Chia, but rather because we believe that the Ubar won't likely turn out to be a problem for the situation. Because only if it's a male child would it be a problem. And in that way, the Tosafot explains how Rav Sheshet comes to an opinion that says that Ubar is Koneh, and it's not just a minority position of Rabbi Yossi, but rather a position of both Rabbi Yossi and the Chachamim. And therefore, they re-explain the machlok between Rabbi Yossi and the Chachamim as to whether we're choshesh the miyuta. Do we worry about the miyut of chances that there'll be a zachar who impact the avadim and the truma from the cases that we saw in yesterday's daf? So now, Amar Rav Sheshet, mina amin Allah, I can prove to you that I'm right. Ditanya, Ebebraita. Ger shemet, if I have a convert who passed away, ubiz bizu Yisrael nechasav, and people plundered his possessions. Obviously, this is a situation in which the ger converted, and a ger is tinok shenola dami. He has the status of a newborn child. It means that he has no relatives. Now, if after he converted, he had children, those children would definitely be his inheritors. But over here, we're talking about a case where he has no inheritors to his possessions. So now it's a first-come, first-served basis. So the Israelim go and run in and grab whatever they can grab because kol hakodem zachah. V'shamu sheyesh lo ben. All of a sudden, after they went and plundered everything, they find out that he did have a son, or that there might be a son out there. Oh, shayta yishto me'uberet, or his wife was pregnant, and therefore there's a possibility that a son was born, and they don't have entitlement to the possessions of the ger. Chayavin lachzir. They have to return whatever they took, because they took it improperly. Hechziru akol, they returned everything. Va'achar kach shamu shemeit bino, then they get the news that the child that they were worried about passed away, or the ubar, fetus that the wife was carrying, was miscarried, and therefore there's no chashash anymore over yorish. Hechzik mishnia, once again they went in and grabbed whatever they could grab because kol hakodem zacha, kana, there they are kone. Uberishona, lo kana. The people that took it up front, we're not kone. If you believe that a fetus is unable to take possession, why do they have to take possession a second time? Or why are those that take possession the second time the rightful owners over here? The people who took it the first time around already had a kinyan here. And so why isn't their kinyan binding? So what Rav Sheshet points out is, it's only because of the interference of the ubar that we actually have a second chance at going at the assets. If you believe that an ubar has no impact whatsoever, then when they took possession the first time, they thought the wife is now pregnant, carrying some fetus, and then she miscarries the fetus. If you tell me that a fetus never takes possession, then what happened here that undermined their ownership? Their ownership the first time was effective. It was true that there was a woman who, his wife was pregnant, and she had the possibility of giving birth to a child that would have been the inheritor, but in the end she didn't. So then nothing impeded their ability to take possession the first time. And so then why did the people who took possession the second time become the owners of the property and not those that took the first time? Sheshet says, what I'm proving to you from that is, it must be that the ubar takes possession in the interim. So that while the ubar is in utero, he takes possession. When it was miscarried, the ubar basically lost his ownership of whatever was there, and now it's once again hefker. From that, I can show you that an ubar has rights. Because if a ubar didn't have rights of ownership, then the first kinyan would have been effective. That is the proof that Rav Sheshet brings to his position. So now, Amar Abaye. Abaye answers similar to the way we did yesterday. Rusha ba me'eleha, shiny. Same way we answered yesterday, which is there's a big gulf between a situation in which someone is a yoresh, where they automatically come into possession of the inheritance. Over there, they basically step into the shoes of the bequeather. They don't have to do anything. It comes to them whether they like it or not. That Yerusha comes to them, and they have to make no active engagement in order to get it. It will come even if they remain passive, even if they didn't even know about it. It comes into their possession. So in that case, yes, the ubar can take possession over here because he's acting as an inheritor. But in a case where you want to grant a gift to an ubar, who says that will be effective? When you're granting a gift, you need a recipient to receive the gift. Maybe the ubar is incapable of receiving. He might be capable of being yoresh, but he may be incapable of receiving. And therefore, I don't see any proof from the case that you brought to our case over here. In essence, Abaye accepts that yes, over here, an ubar is yoresh, But he says that doesn't mean or doesn't show you that necessarily an ubar can be kone. Rava Amar, shiny haltam. Rava says that the case over there is unusual. The rafui marpin biyadayu. Because their kinyan was weak mi'ikara, up front. So now, the way that the Rishonim explain it, the Rashbam explains Rava's position over here is that at the outset of the kinyan, there was a certain amount of uncertainty that surrounded the kinyanim that they were making. So in some senses, there is a lack of gemira tadat. Generally, what the kinyan does, the kinyan is a finalization of a change of ownership. And therefore, a kinyan requires gemira tadat, where there's a certainty to the transference of ownership that takes place. These individuals who went to take possession of the property of the ger, when they went in there, the information that there was possibly a son, or that the wife was possibly pregnant, was already known. Since that was known, when they went to take possession, their possession or their kinyan is a weaker form of kinyan, because surrounding that is a shroud of safek. And therefore, they never have complete gemira tadat when they take possession. Then when they find out that the information is true, then it undermines their kinyan completely. And then they have to restart again and do another proper kinyan later on. Or the people who make the kinyan the second time have a proper kinyan. So now, from Rovo, there are a number of things. First of all, he doesn't believe that an ubar can be yoresh. That he makes clear here. He says it has nothing to do with the ubar being yoresh. It has to do with the nature of the kinyan made up front by the individuals. That's number one. Number two is that Rova believes that you need gemira tadat in a kinyan. And if you make a kinyan with anything that involves a safek in the nature of the kinyan, then your kinyan will fail because you don't have a strong enough or power enough kinyan to take possession of that which is here. Ukeshameta ger, ubizbizu nechasaf, when they went and grabbed everything, ve'achziku lo nitkavnu lachzik legamrei. They didn't take full possession. They had some doubts. Im yesh lo yorshim, im lav. Kmo shehuchiach sofo al tchilato. And then the information really did surface that there were yorshim over here. And that proves that what up front they were thinking or worried about, that in the end came to fruition or was true. And therefore, it undermines the nature of their kinyan. And unless they go back and reacquire that which is there, they don't get possession of it because their original kinyan had a deficit in it. The Gemara now will say, "My benayu, what is the nafkamina between them?" The obvious nafkamina between them is whether you think a ubar can be yoresh. Abai thinks yes, Rava thinks no. The Gemara really is asking the question, "My benayu, in our case, in the case of the ger, what's the difference?" Iker benayu, the nafkamina between them is sheshamu bo shemate. They had heard rumors that he died, velomate, and he didn't die, va'acharkach mate, and then he did die. There are some who explain it, like you just suggested, referring to the ger, but let's assume that it applies to the child, although it could work either way. The situation is that up front, they had no information. They either, the ger died, and they took possession of it, or they didn't believe there was a son. They didn't believe that there was a woman who was pregnant with a possible child. So when they came to take possession of it, they came with the full mind of taking gemira tadat, the full-fledged kinyan. Afterwards, they get information that velomate, v'achar kach mate, and then it does die. In this case, what you have is a situation in which up front, there was gemira tadat, because the information they had up front was that everything was done and good. Shemosha b'mate. Either the ger died, or the child died, or there was a miscarriage of the fetus. So in that case, they believed they were taking a full-fledged kinyan, according to Rova. Velo mate. And then they find out that the information was untrue. And then in the end, the child, the ger, or the fetus passes away. So in that case, when they did the kinyan up front, they did it with full gemira tadat. Then we find out that the information was untrue. But then it turns out to be true. If it remains untrue, of course, they'll be disowned from whatever they took, because then that person becomes the rightful heir to the property. But now in the end, where the end result is what they thought up front is true, according to Rava, the kinyan was effective the first time around, because you thought you were making a full-fledged kinyan. And then you find out in the end, the information turns out to be good. And the information that is good in the end Well, then validate the kinyan you made up front. That'll be Rava's view. Yes, they had incorrect information up front. But that incorrect information made it that the kinyan they made it was a fully effective gemirat hadat of a kinyan. And then when they get the other information, that is, it was not true, it doesn't undermine their kinyan because their kinyan was effective. It would undermine their kinyan if, in the end, that information remains untrue. But then they find out the information is untrue, but then it goes back to being true. So they had information up front that there was some information that would allow them to make a kinyan. Then that information changes to indicate that it's otherwise. And then in the end, it turns out that what they thought was true. Now, whether that is up front, it was true, or whether that means with the ger, it would have to be that way, that up front it was true, otherwise they couldn't have taken possession while he was still alive. Or whether with the fetus, it turned out not to be true, and then true again, it wouldn't matter because their original kinyan was done with such a gemirat hadat. And because of that, according to Rava, the kinyan is effective. On the other hand, for Abaye, as long as in the interim the information was untrue, then the fetus has the ability to take possession, or the child has the right to take possession during that period of time. And since it takes possession in that interim period, then when they pass away afterwards, you have to engage in new kinyan. Because the fetus in the interim took possession of the items. And that means that you have to now make a kinyan after it was disgorged because of the fact that the fetus did not survive or was miscarried. So a number of things. First of all, if it was a case of a real child and the child was really found to be alive, then the child would be the rightful heir and their original kinyan would not be an effective kinyan. Because then the child owned it during that period of time, and only after he passed away did it become released. So in that case, you would have to explain the situation as being that there was upfront information that they thought there was no child. It came to light afterwards that they thought there was a child, and then it turns out that that information was incorrect. So that information in the interim doesn't do anything to affect them. That's the way you would have to explain it according to Rava. According to Abaye, the lack of a child means that there was no kinyan ever over here, and therefore, you could have taken a kinyan up front. On the other hand, in the case of the Ubar, that's where you're going to have the nafkamina between Abaye and Rava, which is that Abaye is going to say the Ubar has an effective kinyan in the interim, and Rava says that the Ubar never has an effective kinyan, it's just a question of what your thought process was when you took possession of it up front, the first time, or the second time. And since the up front you took a full-fledged kinyan, that kinyan is effective, even when the Ubar surfaces or rumors of him surface, it doesn't undermine the Gemir Tadat you had the first place, which gave you rights of ownership. And when the Ubar is miscarried, then nothing has changed. The status quo was that you could inherit or take possession of it from the moment the Ger died. And you did that in a full-fledged manner. I can't find this in the Rishonim, but I would have suggested that Rava's position is the following. The Braita, nobody mentions this. The Braita says that they got information that there was a child, or they got information that there was a fetus that was possibly going to be born. And it says, v'yachziru et hakol. They returned everything to the ger. So then, I think you could explain Rava as saying, d'rafoi merapin biyadayu, it's weak possession because they disgorged it, they gave it back. Even though it was under a mistaken premise, they went ahead and returned it to the ger. They undermined their kinyan by giving it back. You could argue that they don't explain it that way because in that sense they're really being mafkir. There is no recipient on the other end. But they thought they didn't own it, so they disgorged whatever they had. And then the later parties come and take possession of it. So that, to me, could be the explanation of Rava's position. They have a weak kinyan here is because they gave it back and they disgorged it. They basically undermined their original kinyan. And that's why the second kinyan is effective over here, not because the Ubar took possession of it. And the same thing would be with regards to the nafkamina between them, which is Shama Boshamait, they thought he was dead, below mate, and he wasn't dead. But they didn't know that, and they were never machzir, they never returned it. Vachakach mate, and then it really dies. So for Rava, there's no issue here, because they never returned it, they never disgorged their first kinyan. And according to Abaye, the fact that the fetus is there is a problem, because he's automatically Yoresh, and he interrupts their kinyan. And that would be the nafkamina between them. I'm suggesting that's a possible explanation of Rava because of the fact that it says v'yachziru et hakol in the Braita, which nobody focuses on. And I would have explained the Rava possibly in that manner. The Rambam sounds a little bit like that. I can't say it's exactly what I'm saying, but I'm just throwing that out as another possibility of how to explain this. Alright, Tashma. Tinok ben yom echad nochel umanchil. A tinok, a child that is 1 day old, has the ability to both inherit as well as to bequeath Yerusha. Ben yom echad in ubar lo. From here it sounds like that only if they are born and they are a day old do they have these capacities. Ubar, if they are in utero, they're a fetus, they don't have that capacity. That would be a problem for Rav Sheshet, because Rav Sheshet says you can be makne something to an ubar. Ubar can take possession of something. If an ubar can take possession of it, how come in the Mishnah it only gives you the opportunity to have Yerusha be taken and bequeathed if the child is born, not while it is an ubar? Hama Rav Sheshet. Didn't Rav Sheshet already explain that the case there was nochel b'nichseyeim la'anchil la'achim min a'av, that the situation or the reason that the Mishnah over there specifies that it has to be a day old and is nochel u'manchil is a special situation. It's only in the case where he is inheriting his mother's possessions and then bequeathing them to his brothers through the father. V'davka ben yom echad. That only works if he is 1 day old. Aval ubar, lo. But by an ubar, that's not the case. Why is that? Because he died first. So the situation or the circumstance over here, according to Rav Sheshet, is a story or a situation in which we have Yerusha that is passing from a mother to brothers through the father. Mother to the child's brothers through the father, the half-brothers. He has this husband married more than once, obviously. He has children from his first marriage. From the second marriage, he has an ubar. Wife passes away while she has a fetus. That fetus doesn't take possession of his mother's possessions to pass them to his half-brothers who share a common father. So we said earlier in the Masechta that a child inherits his mother. But that is only true if the child has to be alive, he has to survive his mother, which is the key element here. The child does not survive his mother, he can't pass Yerusha on, he does not inherit his mother. As opposed to any other Yerusha, where you can inherit it even in the grave, and pass it on and bequeath it in the grave, that is not true by the case of a person inheriting their mother. Person inheriting their mother must be around when their mother passes away, in order to inherit it. Otherwise it returns to the family of the mother. So in this situation, you have an ubar, who is the possible heir to his mother's possessions. So now, if he outlives his mother, he will inherit it, and then pass it, if he passes away then, to his brothers, who are shared brothers through the father. On the other hand, if he predeceases his mother, he will not inherit that item. And that's what the Gemara is saying, is Rav Sheshet over there already explained that the situation or the case over there has to be this case. Now, nothing to do with our situation here, nothing to do with our question here. The Gemara Nida, in speaking about this Mishnah, says you have to give an explanation of this, because otherwise, my nafkamina. If you're talking about a father and a son in a regular situation, why should it matter whether the father predeceases the son or the son predeceases the father? In both instances, the brothers are the inheritors. The brothers, they either inherit their brother who passed away, or they will inherit their father who passed away. So irrespective of whether you consider their brother to be an heir or not, will have absolutely no impact. If you have Reuven, Shimon, and Levi, and Reuven and Shimon are already born, Levi is an ubar. So now we have a question. Is Levi born or not born when their father, Yaakov, passes away? Why would it matter? As far as Reuven and Shimon are concerned, if Levi is an inheritor, then they'll get it through Levi and they'll split Levi's portion. If Levi's not considered to be an inheritor, then they'll just get all of the possessions from Yaakov split between them. In the end, you will end up with the same net outcome, which is that Reuben and Shimon are splitting all the assets of their father. Whether it went through Levi or whether it came directly from their father, it doesn't really matter. They're going to get the possessions. If Levi was born and then passed away, so then he would have inherited, and then he'd give it to his brothers. If he's not considered to be born, then it will go directly from their father. So it really doesn't matter to us whether you consider Levi to be an inheritor and a bequeather or not, because there's no nafkamina. Either it's going to go directly from the father to them, or it's going to go through the brother to them. If Levi lives, then there's no question. That's the whole point here. The whole point is, when does he become an inheritor and a bequeather? Is it in utero, or is it the day, the moment he's born? There's no nafkamina to us, because if he is or isn't classified, it would make no difference. So now, that's what prompts Rav Sheshet to say that the case over there is a case where he's nochel nichsein. The Ubar is inheriting his mother's property in order to give it to the brothers through the father. There is a nafkamina. Because if, in that case, it's not Levi, but rather it's Yosef, instead, so you have Reuben and Shimon, and then Yosef, if Yosef is an inheritor, he will take the possessions of Rachel, and then he will bequeath them to his brothers, his half-brothers, Reuben and Shimon. On the other hand, if he is not an inheritor, then Reuben and Shimon have no access to the possessions of Rachel. They have no relationship to Rachel whatsoever. So in that situation, it is important to know whether Yosef is considered to be an inheritor or not an inheritor, because the nafkamina will be whether Reuben and Shimon get access to the assets of Rachel. And that's why Rav Sheshet over there says that's what the Mishnah is speaking about. The Mishnah over there is speaking about a case like this in order to make it relevant as to why we need to know that the child that is born is considered to be an inheritor. So now the Gemara brings that, and the Gemara says, didn't Rav Sheshet already explain for other reasons that the case over there is this situation? Given that, then why in that situation does Rav Sheshet say only when it's a day old does it work? Why isn't the Ubar successful at giving over possessions to the other brothers? If you tell me Ubar can be Yoresh, then the Ubar should be able to be Yoresh's mother. And if he's Yoresh's mother, he'll pass that to his brothers, Reuven and Shimon, when he dies. The answer to that question is because the Ubar died first, before the mother. And that is the principle that we learned before, which is that by any other Yerusha, even in the Kever, you can pass Yerusha. But when it comes to the inheritance of the mother, you can only inherit the mother if you are alive or you survive the mother. And what Rav Sheshet basically says is, by definition, the Ubar will always die before the mother. Because the death of the mother will be preceded by the death of the fetus. As the way that Balei Tosfot express it is that the Ubar is a lesser of life or is dependent on the mother for its life. So if the mother passes away, the mother's self-preservation will shut down the Ubar before it shuts down herself. So if she's about to pass away, then she will stop sustaining the Ubar before she passes away. And so by definition, the Ubar will die before the mother dies. Okay, very good. So the Balei Tosafot actually notes what you're saying here, is that this is only true where the mother dies either from sickness or through natural death. If there is a sudden death to the mother, that is either that she is killed or she's in some sort of accident, then this is not necessarily true. In that case, the Ubar could survive the mother because the suddenness of the death of the mother can cause the mother to die before the Ubar is impacted by the mother's death. So that's what the Tosafot carve out that as an exception. So then he says, then why didn't Rav Sheshet say that the Mishnah explained it by an Ubar? Because the Ubar is not psikole. You can't say that every Ubar will pass Yerusha. Then you have to start clarifying, did the Ubar, who died first, did the mother die first or not? By case of Yom Echad, as long as the child is born, then for sure he inherits and passes it to his half-brothers. And that's why the Mishnah used that example. But in the end, Rav Sheshet's answer is exactly that. Rav Sheshet, who already qualified the Mishnah Nida for a different reason, as we explained before, to make it relevant, in addition to that, he now adds on the additional fact, which is that by definition, the Ubar is going to pass away before the mother, and therefore there's nothing to speak about an Ubar inheriting his mother. That will never happen, because the Ubar will always predecease his mother, and therefore there's nothing to speak about here. Now, the answer is so obvious and so good that the Balei Tosafot say over here, Tema, Demal al data makshet. What was the questioner thinking over here? It's already clear that Rav Sheshet qualified the Mishnah over there, and the result of that is that the Ubar is definitely going to die before the mother. So Tosfot offers three different possibilities as to what the questioner was thinking. He says, V'yesh lamar, v'diyada yada makshesh shapir, v'nochem nichseim kamar, el shaya sover, d'hi mayit bereisho. He says he knew about Rav Sheshet's qualification of the Mishnah, but he thought that the mother dies first. So that would be a machloket maybe in Mitziyut then, as to whether the mother or the Ubar dies first. And that's what the Makshe thought. And Rav Sheshet clarifies, no, it's the Ubar that dies first. So now, that's one possibility. Another possibility is, that that there is a situation in which it could be relevant when we're speaking about the father's property. In the case where Kagon Shaloyalo Ela Ubar Levad, in a situation in which there are no other brothers besides the Ubar. And the Shchid Meira says, I'm giving away all my property to these individuals, Imlo Yirashenu Zeh, if this Ubar doesn't take possession of what I had. So you could come up with a case where you don't have to talk about the Nichsei Ha'Aim, we're talking about the Nichsei Ha'Av. There's a situation or a circumstance by which the father gave away all the property if the Ubar is unsuccessful at taking possession of it. So in that case, if it's only once he's born, that shows you that the Ubar has no success at taking Yerusha. Or, he gives a third possibility, which is in the Gemara there in Nidah, there is an alternate opinion of Mar Brei de Rav Yosef, which you will see in a second coming up in our Gemara, which could also explain what the relevance of birth is versus other situations where it should not make a difference if it's the father or the brother in the inheritance. So Tosfot gives three possibilities as to what the questioner was thinking, even though it's obvious that Rav Sheshet himself in the Gemara Nidah already qualified the Mishnah. The questioner either knew that and still thought maybe this idea that the Ubar dies first was incorrect, or the questioner didn't know that Rav Sheshet did that, and he explains the Mishnah Nidah in alternate ways that make it possible to be a question on Rav Sheshet. The answer is that Rav Sheshet qualifies the Mishnah in that manner, and then says the Ubar must die first. And then we invoke the principle that we know from earlier, which is that once the Ubar has died, or a child has passed away, or predeceases their mother, they are unable to inherit their mother, to pass the possessions to their brothers that share a common father. Lememra, dehu mayit bereisha. So you are taking it as a given that the Ubar always predeceases the mother. Vahava uvda. We have a case in which that wasn't true. Upir case, tlata pirkusei. That after the death of the mother, the Ubar was still moving and shaking, which indicates that the Ubar survived the mother. So how are you empirically now telling us that the Ubar must die before the mother? We have a case where the Ubar survived the mother. The Tosfot over here brings an alternate girsa, besides the Tlate Pirkuse, three shakes or movements, says that it is Vita Garsa Tlata Parse, that the amount of time it takes to walk three parsa, the Ubar was still moving or shaking around. So the Gemara says, from that it seems like your assumption that the Ubar always predeceases the mother is incorrect. So Amar Ravashi, Mida Hava Zanav Halita'a, Shemifarkeset. It's no different than the tail of a lizard. When you cut off the tail of a lizard, the tail keeps shaking and moving around even after the lizard has departed. Over there, it's a decoy for the predator to think that he's got something and it's still alive. In the meantime, the lizard can escape. But that is just because of the electric impulses that are in the tail that cause it to shake it around. That's not an indication of life of the tail. Nothing's going to regrow from that tail. Nothing's going to regenerate from that tail. So similarly over here, the Ubar's movements are not a sign of life. The Ubar's movements are simply a residual electric impulses that went in before the death of the mother. But other than that, the Ubar is not really alive. It's just this flailing of the Ubar is not an indication of life. It's just simply an indication of residual electric impulses. So now, here's the alternate view of that Mishnah and Nidah, which is Mar Berei de Rav Yosef, Mishmei de Rav Amar, Lomar, Shememeit B'chelek HaBechura, to tell you that it affects the Chelek HaBechura. So now, again, here we're saying that we have a disproof to Rav Sheshet's position, which is that we have a Mishnah that explicitly says that this child is only an inheritor when he's born, not when he's in utero, not when he's in Ubar. So Rav Sheshet's solution is to say, it's this unique case of where you're inheriting the mother, and inheriting the mother requires the Ubar to survive the mother, and that will never be the case, and therefore it's not relevant to speak about an in utero acceptance of Yerusha, because the mother is still alive, and if the mother's alive, there's no Yerusha. If the mother passed away, the Ubar has already predeceased the mother. That's one answer to undermine this question against Rav Sheshet. The other possibility is to explain the case there, like Mar Berei de Rav Yosef, Mishmei de Rava, which is to say that the situation in Nidah is not about a case where you're inheriting a mother, rather in a case of Bechura. V'davka ben yom echad. It's only if he lives and he's born. About Ubar, lo. But when it comes to a fetus, that's not the case. My taima, because by a bechor it says, v'yaldu lo amar rachmana. That only if they are born to him, Do they affect the chelek habechora? So that would mean in this situation, an ubar does have the power to be yoresh. He has the power to inherit or to take possession of items. What he doesn't have the power to do is affect the chelek habechora, to affect the possessions of the firstborn. The firstborn gets a double portion. But we already learned earlier in the Masechta that it says v'yaldulo. The only people who count against the Bechor's chelek are born children. Children that are born now, they affect the chelek of the Bechorah. So this child that's yet to be born does not have an impact on the chelek of Bechorah. So that will turn out that if you have three brothers, one of whom is the Bechor, one that is in utero. In that situation, you now have a case where the in utero fetus is part of the split of the Yerusha, but he won't affect the possession of the Bechorah. So let's say, for instance, you have 12 portions of Yerusha. So now when you go to look at the Chelek HaBechorah, you will now break it down only between the already living brothers. And then there will be 4, 4, and 4. And that means that the double portion of the Bechor is 4 units. And he'll take those 4 units out. Then the remaining 8 units that are there, they will then be split evenly between all 3 brothers. Because the in utero child is considered to be a brother for pshitut or for regular Yerusha. So then they'll each get 2 2/3 for each brother. That means that the Bechor then would get 6 2/3. And then the other 2 brothers would get 2 2/3 to sum up to the 12 portions here. Because the Bechor's portion of 4 was determined before the brother who was in utero, the 3rd brother, was involved. So the original brothers would have only divided the assets in 3, 4 for each of them. 2 of those, chalakim, 8, would go to the Bechor, 4 to the other brother. So we take the 4 of the double portion, give it to the Bechor, and then the remaining 8 are now divided by the 3 brothers, giving each one of them 2 2/3. Because of the fact that the fetus is only classified as a child for Bechorah when he is born, he does not reduce the size of the double portion, the 2nd portion that the Bechor gets, so he does reduce the size of the pie split between all the brothers. And that's what he says, the nafkamino of that Mishnah is a nido, and that's why the child has to be born. Because if it's not born, it doesn't affect the status of the Bechorah. Because had he been born, there you'd have to subdivide the property between 4 in order to give the Bechor his double portion, and then you would split up the remainder evenly between them.
Had the in utero child been counted all along, then you'd have 3 brothers. You divide the assets by 4, meaning that there are 3 for each portion. The Bechor would get a double portion of 6, and then the other brothers would get 3 each. So that means that this differential between the Pshitut and the Bechorah, gaining the Bechor an extra 2/3 of a portion, and the other 2 brothers are funding that by losing a 1/3 of a portion each.
Child that is born after the death of the father, he does not reduce the size of the Bechor. It's only if the child is born, I mean, that's the parshia in Kitetze that speaks about the Bechor. It says, he has children. That implies that the children are born already when we're coming to determine the double portion of the Bechor. Besura matnu hachi. That's how they learned it in Surah. But Pumpudita matnu hachi. In Pumpudita, they had the mimra in the following manner. Amar mar brev de Yosef mishmei de Rova, Bechor shenolad achar mitat aviv. A Bechor that is born after the death of his father, eino notel pishnayim. He does not get a double portion because, my taima, yakir amar rachmana. It says that the father must recognize the Bechor. Valeta diakir. And over here, the father can't finger the Bechor, recognize the Bechor, because he's not around to be makir the Bechor. The Rashbam over here quotes from the Rabbeinu Hananel, who notes that it doesn't mean that the father physically has to see the child, or even know that the child's around. It just has to be the possibility that the father could have been makir the child. So as long as the child is born prior to the death of the father, that's fine. The problem only arises when he predeceases the birth of the child, then there's never a possibility of yakir. So in that case, there is no bechorah, or he doesn't get a double portion. Over here, you have to do a little bit of innovative thinking to come up with a bechor in these situations.
Remember that we're speaking about the Bechor of the father. We're not speaking about the Bechor of the mother. If you're speaking about the Bechor of a mother, you can have multiple wives and have multiple Bechorim because each one is the Bechor of the Petarechem for the Bechor HaKohen. When it comes to the Bechor of Yerusha, the only thing that matters is the firstborn child of the father. So over here, if he is the firstborn child of the father, then why does it matter whether he is the Bechor or not the Bechor? He's the only inheritor of the father. If there are previous children, then he's not the Bechor of the father. So then, how do you have a situation in which you have a Bechor being born, and the father predeceases him and has any nafkamina? Meaning, why should it matter whether he is or isn't the Bechor? He's the only Yoresh anyway. So you have to say that it's either a case of twins, that would be one possibility, or the other possibility is that he left multiple wives pregnant when he passed away. And then all these children are born after his death, so that would also have impact, because then the first one born would have been the Bechor to his father, even though there are other brothers that exist over here. But that's what I'm saying, you have to do some fancy footwork to come up with a scenario that where actually this would be even relevant, because of the case of the Bechor. Now, the Baalei Tosafot point out that why do you need the Yakir at all? Because the Parshia says, V'yaldu lo banim, that children are born to him. V'yaldu lo banim not only applies to those that are the Pshutim, but also to the Bechor himself. So then, Yaldu banim should be able to teach you everything, and not just about the Bechor. So Baalei Tosafot claim that had you not had Yakir, then you would have used V'yaldu lo banim only to qualify the Bechor. That the Bechor had to be born before the death of the father, but nobody else. On the other hand, once you have Yakir for the Bechor, that leaves the Yaldu lo banim open to tell you that not only is the Bechor have to be born before, but even the Pshutim, the other brothers, have to be born before in order to affect the chilek of the Bechor. All right, now the Gemara continues and says, the Hilchata, Kocho hane lishne da'amamar breder of Yosef mishmei derava. The halacha is like all of these statements that we saw in the name of Mar breder Yosef mishmei derava, I mean the two possible lishonot, which means that both a pashut does not detract from the chelek of bechora if he's not born before his father's death, as well as the fact that a bechor will not be classified as a bechor if he's not born before the death of his father. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Hamizakelu bar lo kana. So now we have, coming to the core of this, the psak halacha. So now we have in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, that a mizakeh, someone who tries to grant a gift to a ubar, is unsuccessful, lo kana. Similar to the position of Rav Huna that we saw before, that you don't have the ability to give something over to a ubar. V'im tomar mishnah teinu. What about our mishnah? Our mishnah is a case where you clearly are gifting it to an ubar. Ho'il v'dato shel adam krova etzel bino. So now you have finally here a way to overcome the mishnah problem. This is something that you had mentioned earlier, maybe it's different with children. And that's the answer here. It's different with children. If someone's trying to gift an ubar in a more generic sense to any ubar in the world, it won't work. But when an individual is trying to gift to an ubar, then the gift to the ubar will be successful when it is their child. And that is because krova dato etzel ubar. The person is closer or has a certain love or affinity towards this child, and therefore they're able to overcome whatever impediments there would normally be to granting a gift to an ubar. So you can see this in the Rashbam. Kruvai zobeno, v'gamar umakneh b'chol libo. Therefore he comes to a gemirat adat and grants it to him. Aval ubar acher lo kana. So what we say here, or according to the way that the Rashbam is explaining it, is that fundamentally an ubar can take possession. Fundamentally, there is an ability for an ubar to take possession. The problem is gemirat hadat. An ubar is not a guarantee that the child will survive and not be miscarried, not die in birth, whatever it is. There are a lot of risks in an ubar. And therefore, when someone grants a gift to an ubar, they don't have that type of gemirat hadat because of all those risks that are involved. So what we say is that when it's the person's own child, they can overcome those doubts and have a gemirat hadat. That is the way that the Rashbam learns it. And in doing so, again, he is clearly saying that you can grant ownership to an ubar. There's a deficit in the thought process or the gemirat hadat, but not that there's a functional deficit or a halakhic deficit. The deficit is in the mindset of the grantor. And that can be overcome by the fact that it's a child, because krovad d'oto etzel ben. On the other hand, the Rishonei Sfarad, the Ramban, and all of those from the Rishonei Sfarad, said that's not the case here. The case here is that we're speaking about a Shchemera, and is an exception to the rule. An ubar can never take possession. It's not a lack of gemirat adat. An ubar is not an ish in halacha. It doesn't have a halachic standing of someone who can accept it. How do you overcome it? Shchem meira. Shchem meira can overcome in different cases. Now we said before, shchem meira can only overcome if a bari could do it through a kinyan. Over here, a bari can't do a kinyan to this ubar, so the shchem meira shouldn't be have the capacity to overcome it. So this is what the Rishonei Sfarad say, is that it's a unique takana for Yishuv Adat of the Shechem Meira. Of course, the Shechem Meira wants to grant possessions to her children, especially an Ubar and a yet unborn child. So for the Yishuv Adat, they made a special exception to the rule that a Shechem Meira can pass to an Ubar, even though normally it wouldn't work and there's no halachic basis for doing it. It's simply an innovation midrabanan for a Shechem Meira. So now, even though a bari can't do it with the kinyan, nevertheless, the shchem meira can do it, and it's a unique and special takana that we have over here. That's where the Rishonei Sfarad. Obviously, the nafkamina between them is whether umbar has the capacity to accept or not, and that is the difference in explanation of the Reshbam versus those of the Ramban and the Rishonei Sfarad. Amar Leh Shmuel, the Rav Chana Bagta. So then Shmuel says to Rav Chana, now the Gemara in other places brings down Bagta. Most places, the Rishonim say it's the name of a place, Bagta, which is Baghdad. And it's interesting over here that the Rashbam himself says, oh, I think it's a place, the Min Baghdad, Ir Shinoladba, that was the city where he was born. Ubikitve Rav Shvira Hitniskeret. I noticed that Rav Shvira, in his writings, mentions this city called Baghdad, as if the Rashbam had no knowledge of Baghdad outside of the fact that he read it in Rav Shvira Gaon, which is interesting. Because Baghdad happens to be a center of Jewish life and Torah life for millennium. From the time of the Galut Babel until the rise of Saddam Hussein, the Jewish population in the city was still there in extent. Up until the late 1800s, there was a huge Jewish population in the city of Baghdad. It's interesting that he only knows it through the writings of Shrier Gaon, not from more general knowledge about the Jewish presence over there. Other places, they suggest that Bagda is not necessarily a place, but whether it's his profession or some sort of other descriptor that is associated with him. We'll assume that it's from Baghdad. So, Amar Leh Shmuel, the Rav Chana Bagda, Pok Aitili Be'asara, go get for me a minion of people, a quorum of individuals, ve'emar lecha be'apayu, and I'm going to tell you over halacha in front of them, ha'mezaked ubar kana, that one who gives over to an ubar kana is successful. So here you have a machloket Eretz Yisrael and Bavel. Rabbi Yochanan is saying that you are unsuccessful in being mezaked ubar, but Shmuel is saying that you are successful in being mezaked ubar, so much so that he wants to publicize it. He tells Rav Chanan Bagta, when I'm going to teach you this, I want a quorum here in order to publicize it. This is the halacha. And the Gemara concludes, V'hilchata, the halacha is a mesaked ubar, lo kana. It's not kone, which is the general principle that we have. Rabbi Yochanan and Shmuel, Rabbi Yochanan and Rav, Rabbi Yochanan trumps in these situations. Never the halacha is like Rabbi Yochanan. The question that still remains is, even if you say the halacha is like Rabbi Yochanan, you can see this in the last Balei HaTosafot on the Amud, which is Peirush Rivam, the Beirusha Ba Me'elah Yachol Yot Halacha K'Rabbi Yossi. The only thing that Rabbi Yochanan said is, HaMizakeh L'Ubar. Someone tried to grant a gift to an Ubar is unsuccessful. That doesn't mean he doesn't agree to what we said before in Rabbi Yossi's position, and the same thing that Abaye answered Rav Sheshet as well, which is Yusha Ba Ma'eleha might be successful at being passed to an Ubar. So the Balei HaTosafot speculate that Nira the Hilchata Kavatei came into Mistaber Tameh. Rav Yossi's reasoning makes a lot of sense, and therefore it seems like the Halacha should be like that, even though Rabbi Yochanan is passing, we're passing like Rabbi Yochanan over here, that you cannot be Mizakel Ubar. And so therefore he wants to bifurcate the din and say, yes, like the Halacha is like Rabbi Yochanan when you're trying to grant a gift to an Ubar. On the other hand, when you are speaking about Yerusha, Ubar can be a possessor of Yerusha. Now the Gemara goes, How damar the bitu? Someone who says to his wife, Nichsai leboni diabu leminach. My possessions are going to go to the children that we bear together. It's about to get married. It's very romantic. And he wants to say, look, all my possessions here, they're going to belong to the children that we have. He was married previously, and he had a child from a previous marriage. Atabrei Kashisha, that older son, the only probably living son at this point, says to him, Hey, how gavra matevi alei? He's speaking in third person, but he's speaking about himself. What's going to happen to me? You just basically disinherited me from any Yerusha, because you gifted all the possessions to the future children you're going to have with your second wife. What happens to me? Amalei, zilkani kechad mibora. You take a possession like one of the children. You'll be a michalek like everybody else. Hanach vadei lo kanu. As far as these children that he will have in the future, they certainly are not acquiring here. Takata litnahu. They don't exist in the world. Since they don't exist in the world, there's no way that they can take possession of that which is there. Hai, itcholek letalia b'makom benaya, olet lecholek letalia b'makom benaya. Talia is usually used to describe a child. A tle, which is a young sheep, is usually used when you speak about it with children. We saw this earlier in the Masechta. It's usually referred to younger children. But as the Rashbam points out, it's not really young children. It means adolescents, more like that, which is teenagers. As we saw before, that Rabbi Yochanan said back early in the Masechta, that we used to see boys and girls walking through the shuk together and socializing, and nothing bad came of it. Do you remember the good old days when the things like that? There he uses the term talia and taliota to describe those teenagers. So this is a child who's slightly older. So the Gemara's question is, Hayit chulak the talia b'makom banaya. Does he have an additional portion amongst the children? Or does he not have an additional portion amongst the children? When it comes to the death of the father, since his gift was unsuccessful to those that were going to come in the future, does that mean that it was also unsuccessful to the one who was already alive? Because he put the two of them together. He said, you'll get a portion amongst the brothers. Well, the brothers aren't getting any portion from his gift, so too this child will not get it. That means that they'll just divide up the Yerusha evenly when the father dies, because they're all children of this father. Or do we say that even though he was unsuccessful at gifting the children who will come in the future, he was successful at gifting this child that's alive already? And that means that he will get an extra portion, basically, when they divide up the assets of the estate. When they go to the assets of the estate, they will basically treat him almost like a bechor. He'll get a double portion. One portion as a gift, and then one portion from his division of the remaining assets of the children. So that's what it would mean, that he would look at the children, what they would have divided up the portions. He'll get one of those portions, and then we divide the remaining assets afterwards. So in a case where you have three other children that are born later, and he's a fourth child, you'll take the assets of the father, divide it in fours. He'll take one portion. And then the residual three, they will then divide between the four of them, because he gets a additional portion because of what was gifted to him by his father, even though the gift was unsuccessful to the other parties. So now the Gemara says, Rabbi Avin, Rabbi Mesha, Rabbi Yirmiyah Damrei, it chulak detalye b'makom benayo. So they all believe, these three Amoraim believe, that the child does get a possession or an extra portion up and above what he's going to split with the remaining brothers that were born after this point in time. Rabbi Abau, Rabbi Chanina, Bar Papi, Rabbi Yitzchak Nafka, Damrei Leit Chulak Detalya, B'makom Benaya. That this child does not get an extra portion, just like the gift failed to those children that are going to be born in the future, it also failed to the child that is alive. Amalei Rabbi Abau, the Rabbi Yirmiyah. So Rabbi Abau, who's of the position that he does not get an extra portion, says to Rabbi Yirmiyah, who believes that he does get that extra portion, Hilchata Kavatan, is a locha like us, Rabbi Bau says, where he doesn't get the portion, or Hilchata Kavataychu, or is a locha like you, who say that he does get a portion. Amalei, Pshita, the Hilchata Kavatan. So Rabbi Yirmiyah answers back to him, clearly the locha is like us. Dikashishna Minaychu, because we are older than you. So over here, is an interesting, there's both sides staked out their positions, and now we have no way to be machria between the two parties. Because logically, we'll see in a second, maybe there is a logic that will overcome. But absent a logic which would dictate that one of the two sides is correct, you have to come up with some other way to decide between them. So he says, we should be the victors in this argument simply because we are older. And we should trump just because of the fact that we are older. And the loch is not like you because you guys are the youngsters over here. So Yirmiyah says, the halacha should just be like us because of the fact that we're older, and absent any other decision, reason for a decision or a chra over here, age should dictate. Amalei, midei b'kishishuta talya milta. Wait a minute, why should this hachra have anything to do with age? B'taima talya milta. It has to do with the logical arguments. Now he introduces the fact that there is a logic to their argument. It's not just a machloket about what they feel the din should be, and therefore it should be dictated by age. There's a logic to what I'm saying. The time am I, so Rabbi Yirmiyah now queries of Rabbi Abou, what is the reason behind your position, Rabbi Abou? Says, Zil legabi Rabbi Avin, go visit Rabbi Avin, Da'asbara nihale, because I already explained to him the reasoning. Rabbi Avin was together with Rabbi Yirmiyah in believing that the child has a right over here. And so he's saying to him, Rabbi Abou is saying, I already explained to your counterpart, who agrees with you, about why we think otherwise. Ve karkish ve reshe ve midrasha. And when I explained to him in the Beit Midrash, he shook his head in acceptance or acquiescence of my position. So Rabbi Avin accepted the reasoning or the logic behind our position, Rabbi Abou says, and therefore Rabbi Yirmiyah, you're wrong. Forget about age here. Your logic doesn't stand up to what I proved to him. Azal legabe. So sure enough, Rabbi Yirmiyah goes back to his counterpart who was in this position with him, Rabbi Avin. If you say to someone, can I take possession like a donkey, does it work? We're going to stop here. There's a member of Amoraim coming up that's going to explicate and help explain this more. But in its simplest form, what he's saying to him is, if you say to a person, take possession of an item like a donkey, donkeys don't take possession. So basically he's gifted you nothing or given you nothing. Similarly over here, when he says to the child that is alive, take possession of this along with your brothers. Well, the brothers are the equivalent of donkeys now. The brothers don't have any rights over here. They can't take possession. So when he tries to compare the existing child to the children that will be born, the children will be born have no rights, have no ability to acquire. If they don't have ability to acquire, then so does the brother who's compared to them not have success at acquiring it. Okay, we're going to stop here two lines down on the top of Kuf Mem Gimel, and we'll go into more detail about this concept in tomorrow's daf.